This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
This series contains adult language and depictions of graphic violence. Listener discretion is advised. In October of 1860, the keel of a ship was laid that, when launched in May of the following year, would be christened the Amazon. Built on the shores of the Bay of Fundy in Nova Scotia, built from local timber in the shipyard of a local man named Joshua Davis, the Amazon would be just shy of 100 feet long and more than 25 and a half feet wide. Registered under the Canadian flag in June of 1861, the two-masted brigantine would make her maiden voyage that same month, carrying a cargo of timber across the Atlantic to London. But all was not well. The ship's captain soon took sick, and the Amazon was forced to return. The captain was dead within days, and, with a new captain at the helm, the Amazon was again on her way to London. That is, after barely escaping disaster due to a collision with fishing equipment off the coast of Maine, and after delivering her cargo in London, she crashed into and sank a smaller ship in the English Channel. Maybe these incidents, all occurring during the Amazon's maiden voyage, should have been taken as a sign that the ship was simply bad luck. Nonetheless, the Amazon went on to do a brisk business for her owners, working mainly in the West Indies and the Mediterranean, for years, without another incident. Then, in 1867, the Amazon was caught in a storm off the coast of Nova Scotia, and high seas drove her ashore. The ship was so badly damaged that her ownership group declared her a wreck and abandoned her where she lay. But that wasn't the end of the Amazon. She would be acquired as a derelict by a local businessman and sold to an American mariner from New York, who refurbished the ship at great personal expense. He also gave her a new name, the Mary Celeste. Welcome back to The Devil Within. You're listening to Mysteries of the Open Sea. Okay, I'm realizing that maybe that opening didn't land quite as hard as I hoped. It wasn't the dun-dun-dun moment that I was looking for, because if you're not aware of the story of the Mary Celeste, then that name wouldn't elicit a sense of spookiness or dread. But it should. And hopefully it will, over the course of this episode. So, a ghost ship is defined as a seaworthy vessel that's been abandoned for unknown reasons. The ship is fully capable of normal operations, but the captain and crew are missing, usually under mysterious circumstances. There are dozens of examples of ghost ships over the centuries, and most have eventually been explained. Piracy or mutiny being the top two reasons for the discovery of a ghost or derelict ship, as they're sometimes called. But in some instances, there are no explanations to be found. By the time 1872 rolled around, a man named Benjamin Briggs was the captain of the Mary Celeste and a part owner. He was excited to go into business with the beautifully retrofitted Mary Celeste as his primary moneymaker. Her first voyage under his ownership and captaincy was to deliver 1,700 barrels of alcohol to a merchant in Genoa, Italy. Briggs arrived at the dock in New York's East River to supervise the loading of the cargo, as well as interview crew members for the voyage. He would require a first mate, second mate, steward, and four general sailors, along with himself, his wife, and two-year-old daughter that he really wanted to see Italy. There were a total of 10 souls on board when they sailed out of New York Harbor on November 7th, 1872. Nearby, in Hoboken, New Jersey, lay the brigantine De Gratia, ready to sail, but waiting on a shipment of oil that was also bound for Genoa. The De Gratia would put to sea 8 days after the Mary Celeste on November 15th, following roughly the same route. Almost 3 weeks later, the captain of the De Gratia, a man named David Morehouse, was summoned to the deck. The lookout had spotted a vessel 6 miles away, heading directly towards their position, but in a strange and unsteady fashion. Looking through his telescope, Captain Morehouse noticed that the ship was making erratic movements. Her sails were set, but set in an unusual way, and most remarkably, not a soul could be seen on her decks. As they approached, the captain was able to read the name of the ship emblazoned on her starboard side, the Mary Celeste. They were about midway between the Azores, a volcanic archipelago in the North Atlantic, and mainland Portugal, roughly 400 miles from shore. As the De Gratia moved closer, there was no reply to Captain Morehouse's signals, and an even closer inspection revealed that the sails were in a relatively poor condition and that much of the ship's rigging was damaged or in disarray. The captain sent 2 men on board this ghost ship to investigate, and what they found was shocking. Nothing. And, well, everything. As far as serious damage was concerned, there was very little. Besides the condition of the sails, the ship was entirely seaworthy. No damage to the hull, beyond some curious scrapes on the bow. 2 of the 3 main hatches were open, and the ship's binnacle, the podium-like stand near the front of the ship that held the navigational instruments, especially the magnetic compass, the binnacle had been knocked over, and the glass case holding the compass had been cracked. But the rooms were tidy, the logbook was recovered, the ship was very well provisioned, and the cargo was untouched. Due to the hatches being opened, about 3 feet of water had collected in the ship's hold, but this wasn't considered a significant amount of water given the size of the vessel. There were children's toys on the bed of the captain's quarters, the remains of a meal and dirty cookware in the galley, and perhaps most importantly, the ship's boat was missing. The ship's boat, or lifeboat as we call it today, was previously secured on the forward deck, covering one of the main hatches. All signs indicated that there was an orderly and smooth departure from the Mary Celeste on her single missing lifeboat. There was no evidence of violence or fire, no reason to blame the mystery on piracy or mutiny. However, further inspection revealed that Captain Briggs's personal navigation equipment was missing. They abandoned the ship on purpose. But why? Captain Morehouse was no maritime investigator. He was a sailor and a businessman. He knew that if he could manage to get the Mary Celeste to port in Gibraltar, then he would be in line for salvage rights, and that would mean a big payday. After weeks of investigations, accusations of insurance fraud and murder, Captain Morehouse was awarded salvage rights and walked away with more than 1,700 British pounds, or more than 300,000 in today's dollars. But the mystery remained, and there were 2 major schools of thought: natural disaster or chemical threat. First, we'll consider the natural disaster scenario. The water discovered in the ship's hold and the damaged state of the sails and rigging, especially after a relatively short time at sea, point to a possible waterspout or a small tornado on the water. The sudden, violent winds that accompany a waterspout could easily have damaged the sails and caused water to pour into the hold. As a precaution, the captain could have ordered a temporary evacuation to the ship's lifeboat while the damage to the main ship was assessed. Then, maybe a strong gust of wind or a weakened rigging line could have separated the Mary Celeste from her tethered lifeboat, and boom, you've got 10 people adrift with no provisions, at the mercy of the elements. The second scenario was inferred upon examination of the ship's log. There were several mentions of small pops and explosions emanating from the cargo hold. All those barrels of alcohol sloshing around would produce a chemical kind of haze that could, under the correct circumstances, ignite into small explosions. It was common among ships that handled that type of cargo, and it was nothing really to worry about. A captain with the experience of brigs would have understood that. But if there were something that put an added layer of agitation to the cargo, particularly rough seas, or maybe even an undersea earthquake, then maybe a strong smell of alcohol was detected, and the captain feared a major explosion was imminent. This, too, could possibly lead him to get everyone off the ship until the danger had passed. Then, once everyone was on the small lifeboat, again, some unexpected event occurred that separated the small boat from the main ship, and a slow, painful disaster played out somewhere in the vastness of the Atlantic Ocean. There have been many theories involving a conspiracy between Captains Briggs and Morehouse that had them as secret partners in an insurance scam, or that Morehouse was actually a pirate and laid in wait to attack the Mary Celeste. Despite the fact that Morehouse's ship, the De Gratia, was slower than the Mary Celeste and had left 8 days later, there would have been no chance for Morehouse to, quote, lie in wait. Then in 1883, the Los Angeles Times published a supposedly true account of the Mary Celeste that had tons of facts wrong, including names of the crew members, as well as details as to the state of the ship when it was discovered by the De Gratia. The Times wrote that, quote, every sail was set, the tiller was lashed fast, not a rope was out of place. The fire was burning in the galley, the dinner was standing untasted and barely cold. The log was written up to the hour of her discovery. Now, every single word of that sentence was false, especially the thing about the log being written up to the hour of discovery. The truth is that the final entry of the captain was a full 9 days earlier, before the De Gratia had even set sail from New Jersey. Then there were sailors who came forward years later and claimed to be survivors of the Mary Celeste, but all were quickly exposed as charlatans. There was also a theory that a giant squid plucked all the people right off the deck, one by one, which would account for the large scratches on the bow. The obvious rebuttal to that theory would be, why didn't everyone get below deck after the first person was snatched up by the sea monster? Why wait for it to be your turn for a violent death? An 1884 short story from a pre-Sherlock Holmes Arthur Conan Doyle was very obviously inspired by the tale of the Mary Celeste. The boat in his story had the same name, but with a different spelling, and it did little to dispel the paranormal myths surrounding the tragedy. In fact, it fueled even more. After being salvaged in Gibraltar, the Mary Celeste would return to service under a succession of new owners and captains, but always under the cloud of being cursed. After all, her first captain had died on the boat's maiden voyage. Bad luck like that is hard to outrun. By 1884, the ship was under the command of a man named Gilman Parker. The Mary Celeste had been losing money for years, so Parker conspired with the ship's ownership group to fill her holds with worthless cargo, then lie about the value to get an extremely overinflated insurance bond. Then he set sail for Haiti. In the channel on the approach to Haiti's capital city of Port-au-Prince, there is a well-charted coral reef called the Rochelot Bank. Parker was aware of it. Everyone was aware of it. Still, Parker ran the Mary Celeste directly into it, tearing the bottom of the ship off and damaging her beyond repair. Then he went to claim the insurance money. The grift was eventually discovered, and all involved were punished, and their careers at sea were destroyed. In 2001, the wreckage of the Mary Celeste was discovered. Only a few pieces of timber remained, along with some metal pieces. All of it still embedded in the coral off the coast of Haiti. But there are ghost ships, and then there are ghost ships. In the early 1600s, when commercial shipping was in its infancy, the Dutch East India Company was among the most powerful conglomerates on the planet. The first publicly owned corporation ever to exist and run with an eye on global domination, the Dutch East India Company was, in its day, more powerful than many countries she did business with. They commanded a massive fleet of cargo ships that did business with the known world and were responsible for new shipping lanes, including the Brewer Route, so named for the Dutch navigator and captain Hendrik Brewer, a daring and dangerous route that greatly reduced the voyage from Amsterdam to Java around Africa's Cape of Good Hope, the notoriously dangerous waters off the tip of southern Africa. The term doubling the Cape first appeared in literature in Homer's Odyssey and has been in common nautical usage ever since. It means to be able to put land in between your current position and your previous position, or to have successfully rounded a cape or promontory. Water and weather tend to be perilous at these geographic regions, and none more so than the Cape of Good Hope in Africa. In 1905, for example, the ship Susanna took a full 99 days to successfully double that particular cape. The legend of the Flying Dutchman goes that a 17th century Dutch captain named Hendrik Vanderdecken vowed to double the Cape of Good Hope in record time in order to win a massive shipping contract that would ensure his personal fortune and elevate the Dutch East India Company even further. Driven by greed and ignoring the pleas of his crew to take any of several opportunities to put into available bays to wait out a punishing storm, Vanderdecken persisted, telling his men, quote, "May I be eternally damned if I do, though I should beat about here till the day of judgment." And he never did seek shelter in that bay or any other, and it is believed that he and his phantom ship and crew are still beating about the seven seas, carrying a dark omen for all who happen to encounter Vanderdecken and his doomed ship, the Flying Dutchman. There have been countless reported sightings of the Flying Dutchman over the centuries, but none as compelling as what was reported by Prince George of Wales in 1880. The young prince, who would go on to become King George V of England, was on a 3-year voyage with his older brother Prince Albert and the royal tutor John Dalton. The prince's log indicates that in the pre-dawn hours of July 11, 1881, off the coast of Australia, their ship encountered a very strange sight. From the prince's log, July 11th, 4 a.m., the Flying Dutchman crossed our bows. A strange red light, as of a phantom ship all aglow, in the midst of which light the masts, spars, and sails of a brig 200 yards distant, stood out in strong relief as she came up on our port bow, where also the officer of the watch from the bridge clearly saw her, as did the quarterdeck midshipman, who was sent forward at once to the forecastle. But on arriving, there was no vestige nor any sign whatever of any material ship was to be seen either near or right away to the horizon, the night being clear and the sea calm. 13 persons altogether saw her. At 10:45 a.m., the ordinary sailor who had this morning reported the Flying Dutchman fell from the foretopmast crosstrees onto the topgallant forecastle and was smashed to atoms. I know, forecastle is actually pronounced fo'c'sle. But look, I'm not a mariner and I feel like a fraud when I pronounce it that way. But the point of the prince's story is that more than a dozen experienced sailors shared the same vision. And then hours later, a terrible tragedy befell their ship in the death of the sailor who first spotted the phantom ship. Now there are a few possible explanations for this. The two princes and their tutor were not experienced sailors and would not share in the near fanatical superstitions that men of that profession held. Also, the princes were still in their teens, young and impressionable, and doubtless susceptible to the passions and rituals of other men, older and more experienced than they were. Did these sailors have an effect on what was written in the prince's log? Of course. Is it possible that the princes were influenced to accept a far-fetched maritime ghost story and to actually believe it to be true? Absolutely. The most likely explanation of the Flying Dutchman is that sailors are seeing a mirage, or a Fata Morgana. At sea, these phenomena can be incredibly disorienting. So in the right conditions, the sun's rays can reflect a mirror image of an object on the surface onto the atmosphere above. If this happens, when what the person is seeing is far enough away that the object on the surface is below the horizon line, it can appear that there is an object floating in the air. And if it's just before dawn, as in the case with the prince's log, or just after sunset, although the person witnessing the image is in darkness, the elevated projected image is at an altitude where it is lit up by the sun's early rays, creating an effect that would look truly remarkable. There have been many accounts of the Flying Dutchman in literature and popular media. In the epic poem, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, Coleridge relays a similar account of a ghost ship that is followed by terrible tragedies. The popular film series, Pirates of the Caribbean, includes an actual recreation of the Flying Dutchman, and again, her sighting portends disaster. Piracy, mutiny, killer squids, water tornadoes. I mean, there are millions of ways that things can go wrong on the open sea, and there are seldom any people around to witness it. Such is the unexplored vastness of our oceans. It is reassuring to know that, at least, there's some explanation for the fiery visages of phantom ships that are so often experienced by sailors around the world. But seriously, what are we supposed to do if a giant squid decides he's hungry? Thanks for listening. Be sure you're following The Devil Within wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. You can also check out our socials at The Devil Within Pod on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Until next time, stay safe out there. The Devil Within is a Cloud 10 Media production, recorded live at Bel Air Studios in Los Angeles, California. Written and produced by Brandon Morgan. Executive produced by Sim Sarna. Our post-production supervisor is Bruce Witkin, who also provided original music for this episode. For The Devil Within, I'm your host, Brandon Morgan.